this, Aiden here with Oddball Pilot, sitting down with Alex Haynes. Alex and I just brought two caravans over from Seattle, Washington, over to Kathmandu, Nepal. We delivered to a company called Goma Air, which is starting up. They'll be flying in western Nepal. And I thought this would be a good opportunity to sit down with Alex and talk to him about his career, primarily focusing on ferrying aircraft, worldwide aircraft delivery, which Alex has done a lot of. We thought we'd sit on the top of our hotel with a good view of Kathmandu as the sun sets. That'd be a good venue for the interview. So let's start off with a little bit about your history. So when did you start flying?
Well, let me say one thing first.
Okay.
It might seem like I have a lot of experience ferrying airplanes, but a lot of the other people I work with have been doing it for many more years, and if I only have 145 deliveries, some of these guys have 700-800. I haven't met anybody that has like over 1,000 deliveries, but when you get over 500, that's a lot.
Yeah.
So I'm very experienced at it, but on the other hand, I'm still a greenhorn compared to these guys.
Right. And I see that a lot in aviation in general. Like, I feel like I've flown in Alaska a lot, but there are a lot of people who've flown there for 30 years. In retrospect, I've got no experience compared to them. But that aside, you have a pretty good understanding of the industry. And in this flight, you actually set the whole flight up and dealt with the clearances and the whole rigmarole of getting through multiple countries, which is a whole other level of ferry flying beyond just flying the airplane. It's fairly complicated. So
you answer your first question.
So you'll do for us.
I started flying when I was 16. My mom paid for a Discovery flight because a friend of hers who was a professional photographer was also a flight instructor at Woodbridge, Virginia.
That's in northern,
right,
towards northern Virginia.
Right outside of D.C.
Okay.
And I really started doing it after I got out of high school, and it took about a year. And so right before my 19th birthday, I got a private certificate out of Leesburg Airport. Continue to just fly around the East Coast, really, not too far, a few states around.
Did you have an intention at that point of making a career, or just enjoying
flying? I did.
Okay.
For a couple reasons. One, I always wanted to fly.
Right.
Since I was maybe 6 years old. Not because I thought airplanes were cool, but because I just wanted to be up in the sky. And I knew absolutely that the only way I could justify the expense that it would take to get good enough to be a good pilot, the only way I could justify that would be that if I was going to go the whole distance and be a professional pilot.
Okay, and that took you, so you started when you were 16, and I know you went to Embry-Riddle as your 4 year to get your bachelor's. Was that part of a very deliberate decision to get in towards commercial aviation?
Yes, it was, because I was accepted there. I applied when I was 21.
Okay.
Got accepted, and I didn't start till I was 22. And, you know, pursuing flying was stalled for me. And okay. I needed something more organized, a better program, rather than, Part 61 school.
Right, somebody that would sit down and say, you're doing this, 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 here's your progression, here's your chart. Cool. I did it work out pretty well.
Well, when it was all done in 1991 was the right after the first Gulf War, there were no flying jobs anywhere. And everybody was saying you could go get a job in Alaska, and it was going to be basically volunteer grunt work, and didn't sound real appealing, and because of the type of flying it was going to be, from what I heard from other people who were doing it at the time, that I wanted to go up there and do that, but it was intimidating.
Right. Yeah.
To take that step, because I'd never been to Alaska. I wanted to go to Alaska, but to take that step seemed like a very big step.
Well, how much flight experience do you have at that point? You had a 4-year degree.
300 hours.
Okay. So you're vastly experienced commercial pilot. So rather than take the bold step of going to Alaska, what did you end up doing?
I went to Africa, too.
That sounds every bit as bold.
Well, I had been planning on going to Africa for years anyway, and I just got very, very lucky that when I had the trip all planned, going with a friend whose parents lived there, who was born and grew up there, who I had been planning this with for years. But 2 days before before I was going to leave, I heard from a friend that there was a possibility of a flying job in Zambia. We were going to Malawi, which was the next country over.
Oh, excellent.
So at that moment, I realized this was an opportunity that, whereas I had been, you know, kind of too intimidated to pursue opportunities here, in North America.
This one fell in your lap.
This one seemed to be right in my face, and I knew that I had to seize the opportunity right here. Go for it.
When you've told me while we were flying planes over that you were actually more interested in originally flying in Africa. That was kind of your fantasy, going to Alaska. Before you answer that, our beer has just arrived.
Well, and you got to have our man's got to have his priorities.
Great, thank you. Right. Appreciate that. Look, we're back. You can keep the peanuts if you want. Cool. Thanks. Nothing like talking and drinking beer on a rooftop in Kathmandu. All right. Back to Africa. So this opportunity kind of fell in your lap. Kind of it appeared too good a chance to pass up. And you were in a position where you could afford to just take off and go. And it ended up working in Zambia for the Park Service, more or less.
I actually went to work for an American couple who my old friend was their accountant in Georgia. And they were managing wildlife conservation and development and community development in North Mwanga National Park in Zambia.
Okay, and you were flying a Cessna 180?
We had a 180, 206, and a Bell 206 helicopter.
Cool.
And my primary job was flying the 180. The 206 had mechanical problems. Ended up not flying it very much. But I ended up getting like 1,000 hours in the 180.
Nice.
I got a lot of tailwheel time. It was all bush, except for the rare trips down to South Africa.
Right, like R&R?
More like shopping trips.
Okay, excellent. How many years did you spend doing that?
3.5 years.
Okay, that's quite a bit of time. I'm going to cheat here a bit because I know some of Alex's history. During those 3.5 years, that's when you met Steve Hall.
I'd been there for 1 year.
Okay.
And I took the 206 down to South Africa for an oil pressure problem. And that's the airplane that Steve Hall had delivered, and that's how I met him in the first place.
And Steve's eventually the man who got him the ferry farm, airplane delivery.
We spent several weeks together, February and March of 1994, and we ended up flying back to Zambia together. It was the first time I got my hands on a King Air, and we got to fly together that week in the 180, landing in the bush. We had a really good time.
Excellent.
So He and I both knew that job wouldn't last forever, and he said, whenever this job winds up, go ahead and give me a call, and we'll see if you want to try ferrying airplanes.
Right. And the Zambia job sort of ended.
Yeah, that wrapped up in the middle of 96.
Okay, and then you came back to the States and gave Steve a call.
Right.
And that was, Steve Hall owns a company called Wings of Eagles, who I also work for now, and that's partly how I met Alex, although I met Alex first at Nome when he was delivering a plane to China. Do you feel like that operation, the Wings of Eagles operation, is fairly normal for a ferry operation, fairly small, and one-person operated deal?
Yes.
Okay.
Most ferry companies are one guy. There are a few ferry companies out there that they have a full staff, they have a complement of pilots, but the pilots are still subcontractors.
Okay.
And Steve had owned his own ferry companies for probably three different companies before he started Wings of Eagles with partners.
Okay.
And, you know, he had some bad experiences with partners and with other businesses going bad, and he just felt a lot more comfortable running a one-man caravan, which was really, really hard.
Yeah.
To bid the trips, to communicate with customers, to, you know, fly the trips, to organize and prepare everything.
All on your own.
All on your own is incredibly hard.
As you just experienced on this last flight.
And I had more help than he used to accept when he was doing it all by himself.
Yeah, so when you started working for him, what was the procedure for him to get you up to speed on the international flights? I know you've been flying in Zambia, but you hadn't been flying across multiple continents.
Well, for the oceanic part, there's no substitute for going with somebody in the cockpit. And I was still pretty inexperienced at the time. I had about 1,200 hours. And that's what we did. First trip was actually that same year I met him in 94. I hitched a ride back to Zambia and caravan. And then we did a couple more trips in 96 before he cut me loose and let me fly a plane without him being sitting next to me.
Right.
But the thing that made me really useful for him was that I like to say I was pre-Africanized, because I'd already flown all over Eastern and Southern Africa. So I knew how things work in Africa and how they don't work. And I understood the weather.
Right.
I understood the politics. I understood the airspace. So all he really had to teach me was the oceanic part.
Right.
Initially.
Right.
And Europe also, because I hadn't flown in Europe. So we started out, you know, mostly doing Europe and Africa.
Do you feel like your training at Embry-Riddle, which is more formal training, might have helped out with trying to understand the planning involved in the ferry flight? The ferry flight, they tend to be more planning involved than flying a 180 in Zambia. Or do you think
probably
you
not.
Picked it up anyway? Yeah.
Probably not. I don't think Embry-Riddle prepared me a whole lot better for ferry flying than just going to a Part 61 school would have.
Okay. Getting more international, just flying in Africa and trying to understand how different areas might deal with aviation.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Even now, you get anybody that has a long career flying in North America, and the first time they try to go overseas, it's a whole new world,
right,
of things to learn.
Yeah. Yeah, I actually always say when I started ferry flying, I had a fair amount of flight time. But it's learning a whole new, it's not necessarily manipulating controls. It's all the paperwork and just the stuff that you deal with on the ground is a pretty big part of it. And air traffic control changes considerably. What kind of planes have you flown in ferry flight? That seems like some part of ferry flight is really interesting. In fact, you get to fly wide variety of aircraft.
I will say anything the insurance company will let me fly. So everything from 172s and Cherokees up to King Air 200s.
Okay, that's a big range.
And that's mainly because you don't need a type rating for any of that.
Right.
If you can just get some experience for anything 12,500 pounds and under, insurance company says, okay, he can fly that plane, then that's usually good enough.
What do you think, in terms of where you fly, you do Europe and Africa a lot. I know you've been in the Pacific as well. I know Steve's company is fairly partial to Africa and Europe. Do you find in the industry that there are just many flights that go in the Pacific, or is Africa and Europe just a particularly large market?
Europe is the biggest market.
Okay. So anyone getting into this business could expect to get a lot of planes here.
Right.
And the two common routes of going to Europe?
If you are flying a small plane without ferry tanks in it, you end up going up through Canada, Greenland, Iceland, Scotland, some other islands like the Faroes, and working your way down into Europe.
Yeah, deal with the cold weather and smaller hops.
And, short days in the wintertime. And, and if you have ferry tanks in a small plane, you can take a Piper Archer from Florida to Germany in 3 days.
Wow. What would be the longest leg in, say, a Piper Archer time-wise?
16 or 17 hours.
Okay. And longest leg distance-wise, the Atlantic crossing from Banner to the Azores?
That's right.
Okay. That's roughly 2,000.
Right.
Right, exact. I call it roughly 2,000. That's good. That's my math, yes.
But regarding the markets, Europe's the biggest market, but Africa is a big market. And since most airplanes are manufactured in the United States, most small aircraft in the world are made in the USA.
Right.
So we are the supplier of those small planes, and anywhere you go in the world, you find American planes. Pipers and Cessnas and Beechcraft and Minis. And
occasionally the planes come back to the U.S. There, do you find a difference between when you pick a plane up versus taking one over, in terms of what you have to deal with as a pilot? Like you show up in Malaysia to bring a plane to Alaska. I know you've done that.
It's much more difficult to get approval to install an auxiliary fuel system when an airplane is registered in another country.
Got it. So that's one of the big headaches.
A very big headache.
And then you've installed the tanks yourself. You've even had them made.
That's right.
Not that you use those ones you had made, but...
and that was funny, because in the United States we make them out of aluminum, which is, you know, nice and light and strong. And a tank might weigh, you know, 40 pounds for a 200-gallon tank. In Malaysia, I had to get tanks made of stainless steel, 75 kilos for each tank.
That helps your gross weight, your climb rate. What's the lifestyle like for a ferry pilot? You've done ferry flying as a full-time job as well. I know you've worked some other jobs kind of supplement it. It can be sort of up and down work. But when you're on as a full-time job, what's your day-to-day? How often can you expect flights? How regular is it?
Well, you got to be really flexible, and there are lots of delays because. Somebody buys an airplane and they need it moved, but the process of purchasing an airplane, especially the bigger the plane, often the longer it takes to get that much money moved. And then maybe they have to do more inspections on the plane. Maybe it's going to change registration. They have to get all the insurance approved. Everything has to get ready before the plane can fly. And then you can show up and pick up the airplane and go. So the buyers and sellers and the ferry companies are trying to coordinate and organize all this. And as like a junior ferry pilot, you're just one piece of this big machine that's trying to move an airplane.
Right.
So you get a phone call very often several weeks in advance when something is scheduled to go. So then you set aside your time for that, and there's a delay, another delay.
Right.
So it can be pretty exasperating.
How's that? I know you're married and have children. How's that work with the home life? You don't have to go in great detail.
Well, it hasn't been bad.
You're home a lot, or else you're home.
That's right. When I'm home, I'm 100% home.
Right.
It's not like I'm commuting to work and gone during the day, so I can drive my kids to school. By the time I had kids, I'd gotten to the point where I was flying, bigger and more reliable planes, and usually didn't have those kind of delays once I had left home. So, plus, I had enough experience that I could, negotiate is not the right word, but just, stand my ground and say, well, when the plane's really ready, then I'll come and pick it up. Meanwhile, I'm going to stay at home and do my thing at home.
Right, so you take probably a bit more, someone's not quite as experienced in the industry starting out, it's going to be more of a requirement to be more available.
Right.
More jump when asked to win. I think some of these guys who do this absolutely as a full-time job, the 800 flights, 1,000 flight guys, think we've talked about this, they're pretty much available all the time.
That's right, they made themselves available all the time. But they also tended to live in places where the airplane factories were.
Right.
So Kansas or Florida.
And that ties into it's a pretty competitive business between people who do this. So that's part of why people, I feel like they have to be available for customers.
It's extremely competitive.
Right.
And so most of the ferry companies, they have proprietary, you know, tricks of the trade and customers and things that they don't want to share.
Right.
But at the same time, it's a big collaborative community.
Right.
And, you know, I think anybody that is has any experience in business will tell you that you need to collaborate with your competition.
But you saw it on this flight, where you're working with Steve and some other people you've worked for, who are kind of helping you out or allowing you to hire their people who you've been working with.
So, yeah, you're... It's not wise to try and be a lone wolf and run your business and accomplish everything that you have to do by yourself.
Right.
You can't. Nobody can do that. So it's a balancing act between you know, maintaining good solid relationships with the other ferry companies and you know, just being very forward about what you're doing.
Right.
Not going behind anybody's back. Not trying to, for instance, if you go to a customer that you've been introduced to by somebody who has given you a flight and you underbid,
right,
the guy that introduced you to that customer,
gotta give them underhand.
It's very underhand. Yeah. And in the long run, shoot yourself in the foot.
Right. You're not gonna get home from your other people, your patriots, your other people working in the same industry.
Because I'm going to need their help and they're going to need my help.
Right.
Even though we're in competition with each other, I get phone calls from other people that I've hardly flown with asking me for help.
Right.
Regularly.
Saying, what's going on? Well, I've called you. I was like, my goodness, I'm missing this one chart. What's the airway?
Yeah. So I'm happy to readily offer that kind of assistance.
Yeah, that makes sense. In terms of like weather delays, do you see many weather? I mean, what are the like we need tailwinds sometimes? Do you get many on a flight? Maybe go back up a little bit. You're going from Florida, picking a plane up from Steve, and you're taking it to Africa. Do you generally get a lot of delays on a flight, or they usually go pretty much straightforward as planned?
They're usually straightforward, although you can count on a 1 or 2 day delay on any trip.
Okay.
For various reasons.
Right.
So if a trip is going to take, 3 days, give yourself 4 or 5.
Okay.
Budget that time. And this trip that you and I did, we thought it would take 8 days, and it took 8 days.
Yeah. It was pretty perfect.
We had really good weather.
Until right
really
here.
Good winds.
Until we got to Kathmandu and the weather went to crap.
But
that's another story.
But... weather delays, sometimes there are no weather delays at all. You meet some people that I think it's because a lack of experience or lack of willpower to venture into the weather.
Right.
They will allow themselves to be delayed for days and days and sometimes weeks. And I think the reason that I think that it has something to do with the pilot is because in all my deliveries, I've never had a weather delay of more than a couple of days going anywhere in the world.
And that will depend partly on what type of plane you're flying.
Of course.
Yeah. You're in a Caravan or King Air, you're an all-weather night fighter. You're in a Cherokee 140, you're in a VW Bug.
So, on the one hand, maybe I've just been very lucky. But on the other hand, those Cherokees and those Cessna 172s, I've flown plenty of those across the North Atlantic in winter.
Right.
And never had a delay of more than a few days. Like an ice storm in New England, you got to wait it out for 3 days.
Right. And then you can also look for where you get creative. Like even on this flight with clearances, we had an issue. We couldn't fly over Canada because getting a flight to Canada was going to take 5 days.
You would lose the weekend.
Yeah. And so you pulled out the charts on a waypoint due south. So if the winds have worked out, avoid the Canadian airspace.
So yeah, you have to be creative.
So you can't just get in this mindset that this is my route, this is exactly how I'm flying this flight. You can say, oh my god, this isn't working this way. Let's see what else we can
Absolutely.
Do.
Like for instance, if you fly directly from New England or Maritime Canada across to Europe all the time, and you think that's the way you got to go, sometimes the weather is real bad out there, and the winds aren't that good. And you can stay in good tailwinds and clear weather by going, you know, 1,000 miles out of your way to the north.
Right.
And because of the Great Circle route, the distance ends up being actually the same.
Right, depending where you're headed.
For instance, that's 4,000 nautical from Bangor, Maine to Malta, whether you go through the Azores or whether you go from Goose Bay to Jersey.
That's right. Yeah.
The distance is identical.
And then you're just dealing with getting into Greenland, which is always our stress factor, might be a little bit of an issue. At least for me.
Well, you know, Greenland, I don't know how all the other guys feel, but even when it's like clear and it's forecast to be clear, I get a tight feeling in my stomach.
Yeah.
It's like the only place in the world that I feel that way about. That no matter how good the weather is forecast to be, I still feel this little bit of dread, you know, this trepidation about going there. Because if you have to go to Greenland, the reason you're going there is because you don't have fuel to not go to Greenland.
Right.
And therefore, if you're about the time that you're committed to going, you no longer have the option of going back to where you came from or going on to the next stop after Greenland. So
right.
it's a very committed thing,
that's why.
And the weather can change very fast, and you're flying up fjords. I always said it's like shooting an instrument approach into Yosemite Valley.
Right, but that's, for everyone who doesn't know, North Star Strike lives at the end of a long fjord going up from Greenland at the base of a glacier. And if the weather's bad, extremely hard to get into. It needs to be a bar, basically. Yeah, there's an NDV approach that brings you down to like 5,000 feet or something. Absurd. Okay. What's your favorite plane to fly?
I like turbines.
Now, why do you like turbines?
Because they're very reliable. And everything is bigger, higher, farther, and faster when you're trying to do this for a living. You need to be able to stick to your schedule.
Right.
So weather is less of a factor, and mechanical issues are less of a factor. And it's ironic that the bigger planes that you fly, like sometimes I get to fly right seat on Citation jets.
Right.
All you need is an overnight bag.
Right.
Then when you're taking a caravan, for instance, you have ferry tanks installed, so you have an auxiliary fuel system, and some of the components of that you're going to bring back with you.
Right.
Plus you bring survival gear that you don't usually bring when you're flying a jet or a King Air.
Right.
And then when you're flying a smaller plane than that, you need a portable HF radio. And all your survival gear, and the fuel equipment. So it's ironic that the smaller the plane, the more stuff that you have to have.
And survival gear consists of a survival suit.
Yeah. That's the bare minimum.
Right.
And obviously, the bigger the raft, the safer you're going to be. But it also means it's a big, heavy thing that you got to carry back on the airline. It's very expensive. And you can't carry a CO2 bottle. The airlines in your check baggage.
You had an opportunity to use a raft once.
Yeah, I was delivering a 172 to a flight school in Spain, and I love the Spaniards, but they're notorious for buying cheap airplanes. So instead of putting a lot of money into a plane and then having it ferried over to Spain, what they'll do is they'll buy a plane and they'll get it like to the bare minimum of airworthiness standards. And then they'll ferry it over And then if they need to, they feel like they need to put more money in the plane, they'll do it there.
Right, right.
So this particular plane, it wasn't exactly a junker. It had just come out of an annual inspection, but it was old. It had 8,000 hours on the airframe and about 1,600 on the engine.
Right.
And
one of those cases where it'd be nice to have a choice of maybe taking it, maybe holding out for a caravan.
Well, that's a no-brainer, but the thing is that, you know, everybody calls you up and they say, I want to ferry airplanes for you. Do you have any King Airs or caravans going?
Right.
And you got to say, well, if I did, I'd be flying them. And, but you know, I might have a 172 coming up for you.
Right.
And that's just, you got to be willing to ferry 172s and Archers for...
When you start.
When you start, for a year or two at least.
Right.
I mean, you'll be lucky if you can get into turbines from there. Now, if you have a bunch of turbine experience, then you can move along a little faster.
Well, I mean, even I came to see you with a fair amount of flight time, and I took a bunch of 172s, Cherokee 140. So in this industry, it doesn't. You can have a lot of flight time, but when you start in the industry, you're still starting in the industry.
And I think that's important to do.
Right.
Because you need to know how to deal with ice in a 172 when you're 1,000 miles from your destination.
Yeah,
of water.
That's not that much fun to do.
But
been there, done that.
Right, but you know we all do it, and we all know how to deal with it, and right. it doesn't stop us.
So back to your story about the survival suit and the raft.
So that 172. It quit on me halfway from the Azores to Spain, so it was about 350 nautical miles offshore.
Off of Spanish or the Azores? Portuguese.
Right in the middle.
Okay.
Right between halfway from the Azores to mainland.
Okay. That'd be right.
And so the engine quit. I was at 7,000 feet. I did what I needed to do to try and get it going again. The propeller was still turning, but there was no fuel getting to the engine.
Right, and I'm going to point out here, there's plenty of fuel on board the airplane. It was not a fuel station.
Yeah, I still had, hours and hours of fuel.
Right.
I still had 4 hours of the flight left.
Right.
Anyway, so I was at 7,000 feet. I was cruising at 7,000 feet. The engine quit. I determined pretty quickly that I had to decide that I was going into water. You know, you can sit there and talk on the radio and try and make things work, but at that point you have very little time, and I figured I had less than 10 minutes.
Right.
And
it's daytime.
It was about 11:30 in the morning.
Okay.
On May 17th of 2000. And you can look it up. November 738 Victor Zulu, I think. And like I said, I had to make up my mind pretty quick of what I was going to do. But this is where training, it doesn't just help. Training is everything. Because with that very, very short amount of time, I had rehearsed, you know, 1,000 times what I was going to do, how I was going to do it. And even then, I wasn't actually in my suit. Normally, flying a 172, you're wearing your suit up to your waist. All you have to do is get your arms into it and zip it up. But I was actually sitting on my suit. And so I had to get into it. And that took more time that I didn't have. So, making the decision early on what I was going to do.
Mm-hmm. Acknowledging you were going to go with the water.
That's right. And then just letting the training take over.
Right.
And when I say training, some of it is what I had rehearsed for myself. Some of it is what I've been told. Like, for instance, you want to jam something in the door of the plane.
Right.
Because when the plane crashes, you know, the checklist says, door ajar, open the door so the door won't jam and you'll be able to get out of the plane.
Right.
But take it one step further. Actually, take a jacket or a shoe or something and push the door open, jam it in the door.
Right.
So it's really and there's no way that door is going to jam shut on you. So that's the kind of thing that there's just a very very short list of items that you need to do to get that plane ready for ditching.
Right.
And if you've rehearsed that, training takes over. You can accomplish all of that really quickly.
Right.
And even though I wasn't wearing my suit, I still had time to do everything I needed to do, get in the suit. I got my position out by radio three times so that when I actually ended up going down, everybody at North Atlantic knew where I was.
Which is what you want.
Absolutely.
At that point. Were you transmitting over 121.5 on the HF?
Nope. I was on HF, and I never went to an emergency frequency. I had a good channel with Santa Maria Control and the other air traffic that was talking to them. 5598 upper sideband.
Okay.
And, you know, if you have an emergency and you're on a frequency and you're talking to ATC, if you have time to go to guard and you can coordinate that with them,
that's great.
That's great. But if you don't, just stay where you are.
Right. After you land in the water, what was it like getting out of the airplane?
There was the only moment of panic that I felt throughout the entire experience. And maybe it was because what happened was something that I hadn't foreseen was going to happen. And that was as I was getting out of the airplane, the water was rushing in through the door shut on my foot.
Oh no.
And I couldn't get away from it. And you know, the waves were about a meter. And water is going into the plane, the plane's going down, and now it's taking me with it.
Right.
So for a couple of seconds, I felt like panicking.
Right.
But I was able to get my foot out and get away from the plane.
Plus, you're in a survival suit's like a big dry suit, so they're buoyant. So you probably couldn't swim down and push the door open.
I didn't have time to even try.
Just pull hard. How long did you stay in the water?
4.5 hours.
What happened to the raft?
I've been told that what you want to do is get away from the airplane as it's sinking, because if you inflate your raft right next to the plane, the tail of the plane can come and take out your life raft.
Right, yep.
So you want to push away from the plane a bit, and I did that, and I pulled the ring and discarded it, and nothing happened. And that was one of the things that I had prepared for, was there's a little snap cover that I had unsnapped and gotten the ring ready to trigger the gas bottle that would inflate the life raft.
Right.
I did that and nothing happened. So I don't know if somehow the gas bottle had discharged or I don't know what malfunctioned, but at that point I had an uninflated life raft.
Piece of rubber. How long were you in the water? 4.5 hours. What was the response back at home when you were assuming that you got a call, that people knew you were down in the water?
Well, on an international flight plan form, there's a line at the very end where you can make a note, if you like, of who you want to be contacted in case of search and rescue.
Uh-huh.
And I always put down the phone number for Wings of Eagles and for Pilot International.
Right, Rod Davis.
In Wichita. That's right. And it didn't matter who I was flying for, I would put down both of those phone numbers in case one of them couldn't answer. And that's what happened. I think Shirley got the call first, even though I was doing a flight for Steve.
This is where everybody works together.
That's right. And so Steve got on the phone with Santa Maria, whose airspace I was in at the time. And they had some details, not many. One of the details was that they had my position. And he actually, by the time that they started calling my wife, enough time had gone by that the first airplane came on station, and it turned out to be an Egyptian C-130 Hercules. That was going home from across the Atlantic.
Wow.
And they had you know, gotten permission from ATC to descend down to 1,000 feet, and I saw them coming, and they flew by, and the 172 hadn't sank yet.
The tail sticking up.
Right. The wings were underwater, and that's one of the things that saved me, surely, was that I was so visible because of the tail. So here I am swimming just a few feet away, you know, 20 feet away from an airplane that's awash, the tail sticking.
Right.
And this is an aside, but the reason that it hadn't sank was because there was air inside the ferry tank. The wings were full of fuel, and there was some fuel remaining in the ferry tank, but there was also about 100 gallons of buoyancy in the ferry tank,
right,
which at the mass of seawater was like 700 pounds of buoyancy inside the cabin of a 172, and that's what kept it from going all the way under.
Which made you a lot more.
So the Egyptians got a radio message to Santa Maria on HF that I was okay, or at least that I was alive.
Right.
And so when my wife got a phone call, the first phone call she got, she was able to get the information that I was alive.
Right.
And it was the middle of the day, and search and rescue was being launched for me, and other aircraft were on station, and everybody was involved. And so there was a full rescue underway.
You want to go into Steve's exact words for
it? Well, he didn't know exactly what to say, and it was really early in the morning for her. It was about 5 o'clock in the morning. She got a phone call and said, well, I've got good news and bad news. Says, the good news, Alex is okay. The bad news is that his plane went down in the ocean.
And he's floating in the middle of the bed.
And so Claudia asked him various questions. One of them was, well, what about sharks? And he said, the water's too warm there. There aren't any sharks there. Well, the fishing boat that picked me up that afternoon was a longliner, a 17-meter longliner.
Fishing for sharks.
It was fishing for swordfish, marlin, and shark.
All right, cool. I just had to get that story out of there. So that's one of the downsides of ferrying. I've heard various numbers like per Atlantic crossings. Like every 400 crossings, there's a plane that goes down?
Less than that.
Is it? Okay.
It's more the range of every one out of every 300 light planes going across an oceanic leg is lost.
Okay, so that's something to think of.
Yeah, but you know, a lot of those are inexperienced people, and they make mistakes that they shouldn't be making if they had been trained properly.
Right.
Or if they were using good judgment.
Right.
Or, you know, and using good judgment means, you know, not accepting an airplane if you have any doubts about its airworthiness.
Right.
It means not launching in conditions that are, you know, really icy or just, you know, really adverse headwinds.
Right.
So there's that tipping point in your career where, you know, before you reach that point, you need help making those judgment calls.
Right. So a good mentor in the business is good.
It's almost essential.
Okay. So the primary, if somebody's looking to get into ferrying, from what I've seen, there are a fair number of people who do this once or twice and then stop. If somebody's thinking of this as something they want to do for a while, do a bunch of airplanes, the most important thing they could do is find a good mentor. Find someone who's done this a bunch and sort of teach them. Okay.
And most of the inexperienced pilots that want to fly for us ferrying, we know that most of them are not going to want to continue doing it.
Right.
Some of them just want to do it because it's like the big adventure, and fair enough. I mean, you can do it and learn about it and decide that's not what you want to do.
It gives you great travel opportunities.
But we know that probably the majority of people who approach us wanting to do this are not going to stick with it.
Right.
So if you're going to make an investment in a person and training them, it's gonna you're gonna be wasting money along the way because, well, if they stick with it, then it's not gonna be a waste.
Right.
But you're gonna be losing money by having an inexperienced person because they're gonna make mistakes.
Right.
They're gonna land in places where the fuel's expensive, or they're gonna land at night where there are fees for landing at night, or they're gonna accept handling in somewhere where they're not required to accept handling and they can do it on their own. Or they're gonna fly into Greenland on a weekend.
Right. Yeah.
They're gonna make all these mistakes. Or they're gonna get out there and decide that, you know, something's not right and they're gonna turn back and meanwhile they burned off $1,000 in fuel.
We've talked about this a lot. The margin in this business is pretty small. It's very easy to lose a lot of money very fast.
Yeah, and that's another thing. The smaller the airplane, the smaller the margin. Mm-hmm. And the more potential there is for delays. And that's another reason why it's real important that before you start flying the bigger planes, that you start out with smaller planes.
There's less money to lose.
It's not... What I was getting at, though, is that... Once you have it ironed out, how to deliver the small planes without losing money, then by the time you get to where the stakes are higher,
right,
you've already figured out how not to, you know, waste your time and waste your money.
Right.
So, yeah.
Cool. So I'm going to throw in here, it's starting to get cold, the sun's setting, and we're up on the roof, which was great when the sun was out, but it's rapidly getting colder, and... Alex has a flight to catch in a few hours, so he has to pack up. So let's just end with a few things. One is it's very hard business to make an actual full-time living. Can you say that's correct? Depends.
If you're an experienced pilot and you get good training in ferrying and you're good at it.
Right.
So that's three steps right there. You can't get insurance until you have 1,000 hours.
Okay.
You can't get insurance until you have at least 3 oceanic crossings.
Okay.
Then you have to get out there and it's like starting all over again. You have to learn all these things that I've been describing.
Yep.
And once you have that figured out, then you know if you're any good or not.
Right.
And everybody else knows if you're any good or not. Then comes, like, the dedication, where you do have to be available for, you never say no to an airplane.
Right.
Unless you've got a really good reason, it's a total piece of junk, then absolutely, you got to stand your ground.
Well, yeah, I shouldn't go into too many stories, it'll take too long, but you did say you were on a retainer at one point, and
right.
You felt pressure to take a plane, but the first plane that came up was in the Sudan.
It was a Cessna 404 that hadn't flown in 5 years, sitting in the Sudan. 25-year-old airplane.
Sounds like a big one to turn down.
And it had issues with where the plane could go because of the owner's relationship with other countries and the fact that it was going to be Sudan registered. It caused problems.
Right.
So that meant that I wouldn't be able to do the trip the way I wanted to do it. And I just knew that that plane was a dog, and there was no way whoever got that airplane was going to struggle.
Not a lot of work. So that's where the experience came into play.
Absolutely.
Despite the pressure, is to say no. That's just not doesn't make any sense.
And so it wasn't just that there was going to be delays. There was a risk of serious safety issues.
Well, any plane's been sitting 5 years. So we're going to wrap this up quick because I'm getting really cold.
Back to. Okay, so the 1,000 hours, the 3 crossings, then the training and the experience.
Okay.
At that point, if you're willing to dedicate yourself to it, you can make a good living at it.
Okay.
Now, good is a relative term. For some people, $50,000 a year is fine.
And you're gone from home a lot.
You're gone from home a lot, but I've never been gone more than half of a year.
Okay, so... Compared to like an airline job, it's not necessarily that you're gone that much more.
Right.
Yeah, that's not that bad.
And then you get to a point where you've expanded your network
mm-hmm.
by collaborating with your competition.
Right.
You're experienced. Your name is out there because clients, then they ask for you.
Right.
And even though they might only get one or two airplanes a year over in Tanzania,
right,
after a couple of years, they don't want anybody else flying their plane.
Right.
Because they meet other ferry pilots, and not everybody is, you know, as good as you are.
Right. How many planes a year constitutes a pretty good living?
If you could get two or three a month.
Okay.
And a trip could... You know, a Europe trip could go by in a few days, an Africa trip takes a week.
Each trip, in terms of flight time for guys who are flying, it's probably 30 to 50 hours per flight.
That's about right.
Okay. Well, so you've got the insurance requirements to take care of, but the primary, the most important thing from starting the business would be to find a good mentor.
Sure.
Ropes. Okay.
So the last step, though, is that once you have your own business, you have a much larger margin.
Okay.
But you also have a greater risk of exposure if something goes wrong.
Right.
And there are like large delays, large maintenance expenses, or a mistake is made and there are large navigation fees from some country, or sometimes things just happen that nobody could have foreseen. And so you end up bearing a lot of exposure, and you have to operate that much more carefully.
Right.
So by the time you get to the point where you're running your own show, your margin is greater. You fly fewer airplanes to make the same money.
Right.
So if you could fly the same number of airplanes, then your income can be pretty good.
Right. Yep.
And there are ups and downs. It's aviation is cyclical.
Right. Couple years might be really good, a couple years might be really down.
That's right. But in the long run, you see it through, and it does pay off.
Huh. Cool. This last flight was pretty good. And yeah. What did Kathmandu?
Worked out.
It did. Excellent. Well, thank you very much. I'm going to let Alex go pack, and Rod Ball Pilot, this is Alex Nate.
We hope you liked this interview. If you found it useful, visit oddballpilot.com for more stuff like it.